Hi guys, welcome to this live stream. Thanks for tuning in and listening if you're at home on Spotify or listening after we've interviewed this. You're watching and listening to the Nurse Break live Q&A webinars and interviews. And the Nurse Break is a platform for Aussie nurses and health professionals and students to share insights into their careers and promote interprofessional learning. I'm Jackson and I'm the founder of the Nurse Break and I'm a registered nurse in Melbourne. And I'll be taking you through this interview. And thank you guys for tuning into our fourth live Q&A. So we've had three others and they've gone really well. If you're watching this live, make sure to post your comments down below and just post where you guys are watching from. Are you a student or a health professional? We'd love to know what you're up to. And you can even ask your questions live. So I might pop them up for Mel. Today, we're joined by Melanie Davies and we'll get her on. But she is a palliative care nurse consultant in Geelong. Hello, how are you going, Melanie?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. You can hear me all well?
Yeah, it breaks up a little bit, but I can fill in the gaps, I think.
Awesome. Okay, so guys who are watching, we might have some technical issues at some points, but that's the world of live TV, live Q&As, who knows? So Mel is a clinical nurse consultant specializing in palliative care. She works in Victoria and lives in Geelong and I believe studied at Deakin University on their waterfront campus. I think they have a waterfront campus down there. Yep. So let's start with, can you tell us about yourself and how did you journey into nursing?
I came to nursing a little bit later in life, I suppose. So when I first left high school, I went off to Deakin to do a journalism degree. Met this surfing guy and ended up travelling Australia and didn't finish that. So we've now been married 26 years. But we had two children and then I'd always been fascinated by nursing as a career. And, you know, when you go to a party and you meet someone, you say, you know, what do you do? Whenever anyone would say, I'm a nurse, I'd do this. Oh, you know, I really wish I'd done that. And then so I got to my 30s and decided that I'd do it. So, yeah, went back full time with two little children.
How did you manage with two children and a surfing husband?
Well, the surfing husband left partway through that to go and live in Brisbane and do fire recruit training. So he became a fireman while I became a nurse. We sort of joked that we both dipped into the dress-up box later in life and redid our careers, but it's been good for both of us.
Yeah. Was it hard being a mum while studying, or what tips would you have to any mothers?
Yeah, look, I think for anyone, studying's hard. It's a really big commitment, no matter what you're studying. But nursing's a hard degree. You know, there's a lot of hands-on stuff, a lot of placement, and, you know, trying to juggle your life while you're doing placement is pretty difficult. I was really fortunate at Deakin Waterfront that I met a group of parents, you know, and we still now, 15 years later, well, more than 15 years, I think, we still all keep in touch and we all continue to do nursing and we've done nursing in many different areas, but we're still a really close-knit group and that was our saviour, I think.
That's awesome that you guys have stayed in touch for 15 years. let's go to it. So what is palliative care?
So palliative care is the care for someone with an incurable disease. Usually people are referred to palliative care when it's reasonably expected that they would only have 12 months to live or less.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess a lot of people would think that palliative care, you know, is something that we deliver in the last 3 months of life, or sorry, 3 weeks of life, you know, but that's not exactly true, is it? And it's more about how do we die well over a long period of time. So can you sort of touch on that?
Yeah. So I think there's this common misconception that palliative care is only end of life care. And end of life care forms a really important part of palliative care. But essentially, palliative care is focusing on quality of life. So our role is to assess and treat symptoms which are impacting negatively on someone's quality of life. So the whole idea is that although our aim is not to cure a disease, it's to palliate a symptom. And that's probably a, might be a new term to people to talk about palliating a symptom, because we palliate a symptom, we don't palliate a person.
Okay, so would that symptom, for example, be pain, or what's another symptom you could palliate?
Sure, so lots of varying symptoms in palliative care. So pain is probably the one that people are most frightened of. No one wants to think of themselves or someone they love dying in pain. And I reassure you that it's fairly rare that people do die in excruciating pain. I think that there are levels of pain. Shortness of breath, dyspnea, is a very common symptom. Nausea, constipation, and anxiety, fear, distress. So that all forms part of palliative symptom management.
Okay, so yeah, it's a really holistic sort of approach, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's certainly not the doing nothing. I think there's this other misconception that, you know, probably 70-odd% of the patients that come under the palliative care team or program will have a malignancy. The other 30 would be non-malignant, perhaps COPD or a progressive neurology. There's this sort of almost handballing sort of thing that people think happens, where oncology says there is no more treatment. There is no more treatment for you. We'll send you to palliative care. And then it gives this misconception that palliative care isn't treatment, and it really is an active part of treatment.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So, okay. I'm just trying to, I had a question in my head, but I've just totally lost it. what inspired you to get into this sort of area of nursing?
So I had a godmother. And she was a nurse, and she was someone I admired and looked up to all my life. She didn't have children of her own. And I was always fascinated, because as a nurse, she had worked in a hospital and been what I thought was a nurse, but then she went off to work in industry and OH&S and lots of interesting things and traveled. And anyway, when I decided that I would go and do nursing later, she was very, very pleased and very supportive. And unfortunately was then diagnosed with a rapidly progressing small cell lung cancer. She lived in Noosa and I lived in Geelong. And I went and enrolled in uni, and she was very excited about that. And the day that uni was due to start, I got a phone call to say, if you'd like to come and say goodbye, you need to do it now. So we jumped on a plane, my mum and I, and we went up and spent some time with my godmother Sue in the palliative care unit up at Noosa there, and said our goodbyes to her, and she died while we were there. So from there I went on and did my grad rotation, and really loved my oncology placement. Wasn't a big fan of the surgical placement. So, you know, you get sifted through and you find your people. And I found my people in oncology, and I was there for about 5 years, and then really loved the palliative care side of oncology, and an opportunity came up to join the community palliative care team, and I took that on about 8 years ago.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that first part. That's quite touching. But I guess a lot of palliative care nurses, oncology nurses beforehand, like, where do you find that most palliative care nurses come from?
Yeah, I think you find a lot would come through via oncology. Yeah, I think that would be the majority. We have a fairly small team. We've got about probably 9 full-time or permanent part-time nurses on our team, and I'd say the majority have probably come via oncology.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just take a little bit of a turn. So what do people say to you when you're about – so you said earlier, like, you go, you know, oh, you're a nurse. Oh, that's such a cool profession. What do they say to you when you say you're a palliative care nurse?
Yeah, it sort of sucks the air out of the room. People don't quite know how to react. As you can tell, I'm a pretty sort of happy person, and people expect that we're going to be really serious folk, and also they just don't know what to say. Yeah. You know, when I was an oncology nurse, it was like, oh, wow, that must be so interesting and so great, and, you know, giving all the chemo and blah, blah, blah. And then I went to palliative care, and all people do is go, oh, that's so sad. Oh, that just must be so sad. And I think, wow, you know, the times of being really sad in my work are probably few. And when they are sad, they're really sad. with good reason, but you know, it's a very rewarding, inspiring job. You see people at their worst, but in that you see them at their best. Like, you see some really great humanity in palliative care.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. And I guess you also would have that same issue with other nurses who aren't palcare nurses. And I guess, I mean, there's a lack of understanding of what a palcare nurse is. Do you find that as well? It's not just the public. It's also, you tell other registered nurses or enrolled nurses or whatever what you do, and they're like, oh, I could never work in that field.
Yeah. Yeah, that's usually the first thing. I could never do that. Yeah, and I think it is just a little bit of a misunderstanding about what palliative care is. I think that there, even within our own, you know, nursing profession, there is a thought that it's more like, maybe in their minds, it's more like old-fashioned hospice, you know, where you sit by the bedside and hold someone's hand while they take their last breaths. But the reality is that I actually rarely see someone die now. I probably saw more deaths and spent time with more people actively dying when I worked in oncology than I actually do in palliative care, which is a strange thing.
That is a bit strange, isn't it? Yeah. Are you at the bedside at the moment, or as a CNC sort of floating around the WHO, you know, consulting?
There's a few different roles in palliative care. So I mean, I work down here in the regional Geelong Hospital. We've got a community team. And even in little old Geelong, we have over 200 patients in the community under palliative care. And then we've got a 14-bed ward, inpatient ward, in the subacute section. And then we've got a new sector of what we've called pallet home. So that's like a bed substitution model. So for people who want to stay at home but need more intensive sort of palliative care at the time, so that's, they'd have sort of three visits a day from a visiting nursing team. And I sort of sit, oh, and also we've got the acute consult team. So we've got medical and nursing based at the main inpatient unit hospital.
Yep.
So I sort of sit now in an education role. So I still go out and do community visits, but more as a sort of clinical supervision role. Or I actually held the position of motor neurone disease shared care worker, so a specialist motor neurone disease nurse, which is interesting coming from oncology, for about 3 years. And I haven't been in that position for about another 3 years, but I still do a lot of the motor neurone disease work in the community. I'm really lucky in my role. I get to flex around and do quite a lot of different stuff and work on lots of projects with the aim of trying to do what we're doing tonight and sort of debunk a bit of the myths about palliative care.
100%. That is exactly the purpose of this interview. So yeah, sort of, there is a lot of variety, I guess, in nursing, but also in palcare, I guess. Yeah. And we sort of touched on it about that misconception within nursing. Why is, as nurses, why is palcare or palliative care everyone's business?
Because we can't escape it. You know, even in our own world, 100% of us will die. And
it's pretty good odds, hey?
Yeah, it's about the only thing guaranteed in life is that it won't last forever. And I guess the thing is that people choose to die in lots of different venues, and people who can plan, I mean, obviously people die, you know, very quick deaths and aren't able to plan ahead for them. But if people are dying in a hospital, being cared for by nurses, then they should be able to have good palliative care regardless of whether there's a palliative care team involved. So for all of us, we should be knowledgeable in the palliative approach. We don't have to be a specialist, but we should have knowledge about the palliative approach to palliative care. So from a health professional perspective, you know, we all should know about palliative care and how to best assess and treat symptoms that are common at end of life.
So what is that palliative care approach rather than just nursing approach? Like, what is that?
So the palliative approach is Well, it's essentially palliative care without that sort of really drilling down into the specialist aspect, because there may be some really complex symptoms at end of life, particularly around pain or dyspnea or refractory nausea. But for most people, those things can be well treated if they're assessed properly and well treated without requiring specialist input. It's like not every broken bone requires an orthopedic surgeon. You know, not every dying patient.
I'm sure they would disagree, but
yeah, well, that's probably true. But you know, not every dying person needs a specialist palliative care team.
Yeah, and I guess palliative care is everyone's business. You could be on any ward, in community aged care, wherever you are. You could be in an outpatient clinic, but we are all at some point as nurses going to look after people who are dying and who have died. So I guess, yeah. I mean, my first experience with it was unexpected, and I'd gone to the shift and I walked into the room and the patient was dead. And they had died during handover, but I hadn't even received handover. I didn't even know who they were, that they were palliated. So, you know, my shift was figuring out all the steps that had to be involved for that shift, but I was never taught how to do that, you know, as a new nurse. So I think there's a lack of education around it as well for at the nursing education level.
Yeah, and to, you know, there's the things that you would have then had to physically have done for that patient as far as, you know, preparing them to be transferred. But the thing that perhaps left you really vulnerable in not knowing that is, what about the family? You know, how did you face having that conversation when they have just imminently lost someone and you've just walked straight into that situation? I mean, that's your team let you down on that one.
We got to the, yeah. We will touch on communication and difficult communication, I guess, a bit later on. So it's good that you touched on that. The second part of this question is, I guess, how do we break those conversational barriers around dying, terminal illness and palliative care? I know that's a really heavy question.
So when you were saying about palliative care being everyone's business, I sort of was talking then about that our healthcare community, but really palliative care is everyone, our whole community, a whole community's business. If we look back 100 years ago, when someone in our community was dying, the community would rally together and we would care for someone at home. You know, there might be a doctor who would get called, who would, you know, maybe come and spend 10 minutes by the bedside and feel for a pulse and, you know, maybe administer some medication. But all of the care and all of the support and all of the planning was done by family, relatives, neighbours, community leaders. And then we sort of moved on to this outsourcing, I suppose, of palliative care, where we suddenly thought that dying needed to happen with a doctor and a nurse and a call bell inside the walls of a hospital. And as a community, we lost the ability to care for ourselves, because not all death is complex. You know, being able to provide support and care for a family while they're at home is part of the community's business in palliative care. It doesn't mean that everyone has to, you know, be able to assess for pain or nausea or all those things. It's all the other things that go around when someone's dying.
So do you think it's sort of become over-medicalized and, you know, almost a business?
Yeah, in many cases, yes. Well, certainly funerals have become business, big business, crazy expensive money business. Yeah.
And you see the ads, you know, on TV, like, prepare for your funeral early. And, you know, it's they're really weird ads to watch on TV, you know, buy insurance for your funeral. So, and, you know, it's a lot of money. So how, in other ways, has it become over-medicalized, would you say, healthcare?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up those ads, because what I've noticed in those ads is that no one uses the word dying. Like, these are ads for funerals. And they don't say die. They say passed on, passed away, you know, all of those sort of other terms to describe dying that don't actually use the word death or dying. You know? So that's a way that things have changed too. We've tried to I don't know, soften it? Is it softening? I don't know. All these euphemisms actually make it really, can make it really difficult.
Scared of dying, you know, the community, not the community, there's a lack of transparency about the concept of dying, I guess. And, but, you know, that's not necessarily across all cultures. I mean, we're not referring to, you know, there's so many different cultures and religions and practices. So it's very hard to, we're generalizing, I guess.
Yeah. So other ways that we try and break down these barriers are some of the things that we're, you know, we try and do around the, in the compassionate community space. So you know, there's some really movers and shakers in that area, particularly the Groundswell Project out of the Blue Mountains, who are doing some fabulous work, and Palliative Care Victoria and Palliative Care Australia. And things like having Palliative Care Week, which was the last week in May, and just trying to get the conversation out in the community. And I held a virtual death cafe in Palliative Care Week, which was taking a bit of a risk. So the year before, I'd held an actual death cafe at a cafe, and we had arranged for about 40 people to come, and nearly 60 showed up, and we thought, gosh, where did all these people come from? But it was fantastic. People just came in and talked about anything. It's really organic. There's no structure, and people just have it as a safe place to talk about death or dying. But taking it online because of COVID was a bit of a risk, because I thought, who's going to want to do that? Says us talking online. But we ended up with 27 people in the Death Cafe, which was fabulous, and the conversations were really great. So having things like that help.
What were these people with life-limiting illnesses, or were these people with family members? And I guess the second part is, what were you actually talking about? What were some of the most common things that people were worried about talking or wanted to know?
Yeah, so it was a mix of some health professionals and some people from the community. We didn't ask them, you know, what brought them there as such, because I guess that was, you know, just around trying to not bring anyone's illnesses to the forefront or anything, unless they wanted to talk about that. There were a lot of people who had had bereavement and grief, and they were reflecting on their experiences of death and dying in their world, which was really interesting, because it's funny that some of the small things that people do for people are the ones that they remember, the most important things to them. And that's really nice to reflect on. And then we also had some people, so we had one of the local funeral operators there, so people could ask questions, and particularly around this time where funerals have been restricted to very small numbers, that's had an enormous impact on people's grief and their ability to sort of share grief with people. So there was a lot of talk about that. There were some death doulas who showed up.
What's a death doula?
Yeah, well, I asked them to explain it, because I sort of thought I knew, but it's interesting to hear from their perspective. And really, a death doula is that sort of, take it back 100 years, and it's someone who works to support the dying. So they are not necessarily a trained health professional or psychologist or anything, but they help navigate, I suppose. So they're the familiar face who can be there in the middle of the night if that's when it's needed, who can direct you to a palliative care team or the type of funeral, can have help have conversations with family. So it's a really great role, and I think we're seeing a bit more of that. There's been some well-known death doulas. Be interesting. I'm going to try and get in contact with them and see what we can do. But Ben Lee, the new musician, he's a death doula, and Imogen Bailey, I think she's I think she was on Big Brother about a gazillion years ago. Oh, okay. She was a sort of
that's a bit random.
Yeah. Well, she was a model and, you know.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, quite a celebrity in the day. Yeah. And yeah, she's taken a role on as death doula. So yeah, interesting.
I've never heard of I've heard of a doula before. I never knew what it were. I've never heard of a death doula. But there you go. I'll have to do some more reading on what about that. I guess we've touched on it a bit, but is it better to die at home or in hospital? This is a question that was sent in to me. And how do we support families to care for people at home?
Yeah, it's interesting. The statistics say that 70% of people choose to die at home in Australia, but only 15% do. And I find that really quite worrisome if that those statistics are true. We actually do, where I work, we keep a record of that. So we have a conversation around where people want to die. And that conversation happens over and over because people will change their minds for different reasons. And then we record where they actually died. So did they die in their place of choice? And we find that actually our statistics are closer to 50% of people die at home. Which is good, if that's what they want. Is it better to die in hospital or at home? I suppose that depends on your values and what's important to you. There's no right or wrong answer. Even within your own family, you'll find people have very different viewpoints to that. Someone who lives alone, of course, that's going to be really hard for them to die at home, because despite there being quite good services in place, the majority of the work of the dying falls to family and community. So if you don't have a network, it's very difficult to die comfortably at home. So there, in between the home or hospital, there is the palliative care unit, sort of specialist units that are available, or hospices. I don't know. I personally would like to die at home. You know, I've got a nice fire going here.
By a fireplace behind you.
Yeah. Live out on a property where I've got beautiful views. I would love to die at home, but do I think my family could manage that? I don't know. And so I guess I think I would like to die wherever my family would be comfortable with me dying. And that's what a lot of people answer. So I think that my husband would be more likely to be able to die successfully at home than I would be. Does that sound mean?
I mean, it makes sense.
But, you know, and I mean, it's an interesting conversation.
We'll have to put him through a crash course.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the manual.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. And some people think that they want to die at home and then maybe towards the end decide that, no, actually I would feel safer in hospital, and that's okay. We facilitate that.
Someone's dying and that decision has been made that they want to die at home. How does the family, how does the logistics of that actually happen?
Yeah, well, like hopefully hopefully we've been referred early enough that we're not meeting them at the crux of, you know, suddenly we're getting breathing changes and someone's in the act of dying, which does happen. Sometimes we'll get a referral that late, at which point there's nothing really we can do to have an impact on anything. But hopefully we've had conversations that include all of the people. And then it would be a matter of, we plan ahead as far as what medications we might need in the home. So one of the things, of course, that would be a sign that someone's deteriorating and perhaps moving into a pre-terminal phase is that they may not be able to swallow, which is when we'd have to think about converting any oral medications into subcutaneous medications. Might be an interesting point for people. We don't use intravenous medications in palliative care. I don't know if people would be interested in that. So we do use syringe drivers to manage sort of background medications and breakthroughs, and you know, a lot of it is about conversation and expectation and letting family know what this will look like, explaining what someone dying may look like, and being on call. So we've got 24-hour on call round the clock.
Okay. Sorry, you just cut out the last part. Okay, so I guess there's quite a lot of support there. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're there. Guys, if you're watching, just feel free to chuck in where you guys are, just in the comments on Facebook, where you're watching from and what do you do. And hello to Nikki Hepburn from Geelong. I don't know if you guys know each other.
Well, there's more than two people in Geelong.
Just making sure. We've got Bobby Mack from far west New South Wales. Hello, thanks for joining. Carolyn says, community power care nurses were fantastic, calling in to check on mum and on the four of us. We cared for mum at home until she passed April 20th this year, a difficult time, especially with COVID restrictions in place at the time. We've got Louise. Hey, Louise, thanks for tuning in. Hello from Vic, Ian, and student RN, very interested in power care postgrad. We've got Daphne, hello, from Queensland. We've got Christy from Southeast Tassie, student enrolled nurse. We've got Cam from Winchelsea. Anyway, so thanks for joining in. And guys, keep posting where you guys are from. I could keep going on, but there's too many to go through. I guess we've touched on it about the swallowing issues, the pain, but what, for those who haven't experienced it, does dying look like?
This will be a very big generalization because, of course, person-centered care, it can look different for people depending on lots of things, including their disease. So, for example, dying in motor neuron disease might look quite different to dying with a cancer. But generally speaking, someone will get more sleepy, have less energy, require less intake. And that's one of the things that I think is one of the most distressing things for families, is when their loved one isn't wanting food. As carers and nurturers, you know, our culture says that we feed people to keep them well and healthy, and when they can't take food or are refusing food, that can be a really difficult point for people. Probably more difficult for people is when they stop drinking, because a lot of people then become worried that their loved one is dying of thirst or malnutrition. So at that time, it's when we would explain that actually our body's really good at telling us what we do and don't want. And as it starts to slowly shut down, our desire for food and water becomes non-existent. And in fact, by force feeding or you know, trying to pour drinks in someone's mouth, it actually can be more distressing for them. So we talk to people then about, you know, really immaculate mouth care being so important. So it's probably one of my biggest bugbears if I go into a home where someone's being cared for by a team and they've got a dry mouth and, you know, that caked tongue that's all drawn back. You know, that's just not a nice thing for anyone. And then I guess we would explain to people about breathing changes. So for some people, they may have periods where their breathing gets really quick and shallow, and then might go back to normal, or they may have apneic periods, so periods where they don't actually take a breath for a while. That can be really confronting. Stressful. And even as a fairly experienced nurse in dying, it can be, because you sort of move forward to say,
double check,
it looks like they may have died, and they take that big breath.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it really can be quite. So just explaining that to family is really important, because if we find it hard as health professionals, imagine what the family are feeling when they're with someone. So just that really good education and communication. So when someone is actually taking their last breaths, they may be those sort of chain stoking breaths. At some point they will have become non-responsive, unconscious. and they'll have, you know, peripheries will shut down. So you often get cold peripheries or mottling. You'll find that there's sort of, you know, no return in your fingernails and things like that. Is that the sort of thing you're asking?
Yeah, that is what I'm asking, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess a lot of people haven't experienced this yet, or their students. So
yeah. And I think if you are a student and that you hear in handover that there is someone who's imminently dying, I think it would be really important to go to, you know, whoever's managing who you're allocated to that day and just ask them if you can be a part of that, because it is something that all of us need to experience at some point. But also in doing that, make sure that you're getting well supported, because it's a difficult thing.
Yeah, I think those are really wise words. What are the most common misconceptions about palliative care and palliative care nurses?
I think the most common misconceptions about palliative care is that it is just end-of-life care. So can I use this opportunity to say some of the things that we do that are not that?
Go crazy.
We work on some really fabulous sort of ways of improving people's quality of life. And where I work, we've got a program that's funded by the Geelong Hospice Foundation called the Have a Go program. And that came about because a young local mum, before she died, wanted to learn how to make cheese. So one of our volunteers said, well, I can do that. So off they went and they made cheese together, and then they shared the cheese and a glass of wine, and some cheese came into the office and it was really beautiful. And it actually just made such a difference to this woman that we'd actually listened and gone about making it happen. And so we started this sort of, we named the program Heidi's Have a Go. Her name was Heidi. And we then put it out there to people saying, doesn't matter how crazy it sounds, let us know. We'll see what we can work out. So there's been some really great Have a Go's. Glass blowing. There's a guy who was almost agoraphobic because of his dyspnea and anxiety that went along with that. But he was a keen shooter. Is that what they're called? Like with guns down at like a shooting range. And yeah, so they found, yeah. So he actually leaves.
You didn't give him a gun, did you?
Yeah. Yeah, we did.
Oh, but, okay.
But at a shooting range, like where it's all, okay, you know. Good. He's now doing that regularly, and that was someone who couldn't leave the house before. And then most recently we have we've purchased some virtual reality goggles, and so we're working with a company who do virtual reality with a medical background. So they were originally designed for dental patients to relieve anxiety during dentistry, but we have adapted that to have some relaxation and just some general escapes. So you know, you can do it. We went out to one of our patients is a 17-year-old girl with a grade 4 glioblastoma, and she actually was diagnosed on returning from a school trip to Paris. So from that time, her life turned upside down. And on her 17th birthday, we went out to her house with the virtual reality goggles and took her back to Paris. And it was phenomenal. Like, it was just so amazing. So, you know, there's some of the misconceptions that palliative care is all about death and dying. It certainly is part of a lot of the work we do, but so much of it is about quality of life and experiences.
And creating happiness. And that is a cool sort of look at the future of palliative care, I guess. That was actually one of my future questions. But virtual reality, that's something that's really cool. They've been using that in COVID as well. In the EDs, some hospitals, you know, they get an iPad out so they can sort of communicate. But yeah, that's really interesting. We'll touch more on maybe some other sort of things for the future.
And the misconceptions about palliative care nurses is that we're all cranky, old, need to retire nurses. We're not where old nurses go to die.
Yeah, right. Okay. wow. There you go. What? Where do I go from there? What I was going to say. Yeah. So my next question is, how does one die with dignity? And how do we facilitate a death with dignity?
Yeah. I think that's where really skilled conversation comes in, because dignity is different to different people, and people's expectations of what dying with dignity means is different to people. Like, for me, please, I need to have mascara on. You know, that is my thing. I don't do life without mascara. So, you know, to me, that would be a much more dignified death if I actually had mascara on. But, you know, it can be something like that, or it can be something much, much more for people. But I think it's one of those things that comes from conversation and really knowing what people's wishes are for end of life. And I suppose that's where, you know, one of our sort of skills is advanced care planning. So we write people's advanced care directives with them. And the conversations in advanced care directives are really interesting conversations, because the first part of an advanced care directive is a values document. So it's basically, I explain it to people that if you were in an accident and you were brought by ambulance into the ED and you couldn't say who you were and what was important to you, this document is what they will find on their system. It's a reminder to everyone to look for an advanced care directive. And it will give them a picture of who you are, not just this is John who's come in with a head strike and, you know, that's all they know. But, you know, this is John who has this disease, and what's important to him, what he values, is being able to have a conversation with his family. So essentially, if you're deciding what you're going to do for me medically, know that me having conversation with my family is a very, very valuable part of my life. So it won't be dignified to me to not have that. So I would rather then not have the treatment, perhaps life prolonging treatment, if it's going to cost me that quality of life. So okay. Dignity about it, but not dying with terrible symptoms, you know, that's not a dignified way to die. If you're dying with pain that hasn't been well managed, or nausea or vomiting that hasn't been well managed, you know, that's certainly a huge part of a palliative care team's role. And I guess that's probably an important thing to say, is that, I mean, we've sort of focused on nursing, but the palliative care team's a really broad one. So medical, nursing, allied health, so physio, OT, and supportive care, psychology, grief and bereavement, social work, spiritual care work. So it does take a whole team to provide good palliative care.
One big team. And I guess following on from that, this is a question about euthanasia, and I don't know if you want to, I'll ask you it and we'll see how we go. But so the Palliative Care Nurses Association believes that voluntary euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide is completely distinct from palliative care. And I've taken this from their website. And it raises a host of like ethical and practical challenges that implicate our nursing. So I guess, have you had experience with voluntary assisted euthanasia in your practice?
Yeah, I think it's when the act was first being discussed and tabled and then passed, I think that there was an assumption that voluntary assisted dying would sit within palliative care. And I think it's really important that the distinction is made between the two. So while palliative care aims to improve quality of life, voluntary assisted dying obviously has a different take on things. But I think that where they mesh and where we do need to work together on that is that if someone's requesting voluntary assisted dying, then it is more than likely that they have symptoms that are not being managed. Because if you're choosing death early, at a time of your choice, what's behind that? Is it that there's no hope? Is it that there's no control? Or is it that there are physical or emotional symptoms that are not being managed? And if it is that, then that certainly sits within the palliative care arena to assess those and have those discussions. So we do get referrals because someone might have gone to their GP or their oncologist and said, I want to talk about voluntary assisted dying. We do get those referrals, and that's okay because we want to explore what's brought them to that point that they're exploring voluntary assisted dying. But interestingly, to actually go through with voluntary assisted dying, you'll need to have two doctors. One is a GP that has a minimum of 5 years tenure, and the other is a specialist in your disease. So it cannot be a palliative care physician, because a palliative care physician isn't a specialist in one specific disease. So it would have to be an oncologist or a neurologist or cardiologist who is that second doctor. So in that way, it doesn't sit within palliative care.
Okay, yeah, that actually clear. I personally wasn't able to clearly distinguish that difference. So that was that explains it to me. So I assume other people understand that better.
Yeah.
It is a touchy topic, but I can see now how it sort of fits underneath it, but not really.
Yeah.
And how this.
Well, I think we have to be work together because certainly you can't have voluntary assisted dying unless you have a terminal disease. So therefore, you that then means that you would perhaps be a palliative care candidate. And also, yeah, just around. Who's going to support that person while they're going through this process as well? Because that sits under palliative care. So we do have people within the program who have gone down the pathway of accessing voluntary assisted dying, but it doesn't actually sit with us as part of the decision-making team.
Okay. So we sort of touched on this again a little bit earlier, but it's about communication and... You know, one of the biggest things that I guess freaks people out is, you know, the difficult communication or conversations, difficult conversations, really, with family members or with someone who, okay, is going to die, and to explain that in a way to them that it clicks. So I guess how do you approach an end of life conversation with a patient, but also with family members?
Yeah, I think. People develop their own style of communication, which is really important. But I think there are some key things that go with difficult conversations. And the first one is making sure that the time is right. So quite often, as you'll know, as nurses perhaps working in the wards, a medical team might come in, drop a bombshell on someone and walk out. And as the nurse, you pick up the pieces when the team just sort of, you know. And one of the important things to say is, do you want to talk about this now? I'm happy to come back if you want to catch your breath, I'm happy to come back. Because we know that having a conversation at a time when someone's super distressed, it's not going to hit the mark, is it? You know, you really need to just let people sort of settle into things. So picking the timing is really important. And creating a space where someone feels safe and comfortable is really important. So you don't do it when you've got 5 minutes left of your shift and you're suddenly looking at your watch and needing to go off and, you know, the nun's yelling that the shift's finished, get out, I'm not paying overtime, whatever happens. The other thing about conversations is that they need to be empowering. I think sometimes as health professionals, we hold a lot of information, but if we just blurt out what we know to people, we actually disempower them at that point. So it's a little bit of asking, what would you like to talk about? What would you like to know? How much would you like to know? And then being quiet. Like silence is the way to go. People often say, I don't want to say the wrong thing. People rarely say that someone said the wrong thing to them if they're asking, what do you, you know, what, how can I help you? There's a couple of acronym type things too. So if people are interested in, and again, conversation skills are something every nurse and health professional should have some training in. And I think it's a bit underdone in undergrad studies. There is a great program run by the Cancer Council on difficult conversations. And in fact, I think they're doing them now online. So it's a 60-minute online, which it would be well worth anyone doing. Just about setting up.
What was it called again? Sorry.
So it's the Victorian Cancer Council. And it's called, having difficult conversations. It's an online module that you can do. So they do them face to face in normal circumstances where they use actors as patients, and you can actually practice in a safe environment. And you know, you can call time out, or this conversation's gone a bit haywire because I've led it in the wrong direction, call time out, rewind, do all those sorts of things, which is, they're really valuable courses. I actually facilitate them down our end of the world. So if there's anyone who wants to do that down this way, get in touch. But yeah, there's some really easy sort of acronym things that you can learn as well. Like, so NURSE as an acronym, for example, if you come across a patient who's clearly worried, distressed, angry, showing some emotional cues, rather than go, oh, too hard, don't want to have the conversation, you can use these acronyms to help you. So NURSE would be N, so name it. I can see, you know, you're feeling really upset or something's really bothering you. I understand this is really difficult for you, so you show understanding. This is going to test me now. I should have written it down. it goes through R, S, and E. So essentially it's about responding and then supporting and showing empathy. So it just gives you this little toolkit that you can run through that gives you a way of just approaching when sometimes people want to run away from a hard conversation. And I tell you what, having good, difficult conversations is about the most rewarding thing that can happen. When you walk out of that room and think, wow, I really made a difference in that conversation, it's huge.
Powerful, I guess. And I guess during those difficult conversations, what are some of those phrases for death do you use? So, I mean, you've got your carked it, you're going up to heaven. What are some of the phrases or ways that we can describe death?
Yeah, I think probably what we would do mostly is we would use what we call mirroring. So just the way that we would mirror someone's body language.
For a moment, hang on. There we go.
Are we back? I was just saying about mirroring. Just like we would mirror someone's body language to create an environment of openness, that we would mirror the way someone else approaches the words. So it would be really harsh if someone said, I'm really worried about what happens when my mum passes away, and I come back with, well, when your mum dies, like, that's harsh. So I would mirror that and say, when mum passes away, blah, 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 this is what will happen. Mm-hmm. As much as I want to get death literacy out there, I certainly don't want to smack people in the face with it, because that will shut down a conversation as quickly as you can start it. So just using the same terminology. Where that gets difficult is if they're using a terminology and you're not quite sure what they mean. So, you know, sometimes people will say something like, oh, you know, when the time comes, and you say, what do you mean by when the time comes? You know, just to clarify, because they might mean when the time comes that they can no longer wipe their bottom, and you've jumped to when the time comes that they die. So it's really important to just keep checking in that you're on the same page. That's what's so hard about using phrases.
Yeah, I personally have never had to be in one, but it would give me anxiety. But I feel a little, I think with the acronyms and what you've said there, I think it would make me a little bit more comfortable to be able to, to take that conversation to fruition.
Yeah.
Sort of a similar question, sort of not, but what advice, I've spelt that wrong, but do you have for nurses to deal with grief from both themselves, I guess, and patients' families?
Yeah, look, I think as nurses, we are just so hard on ourselves, and we're generally so busy that we try and shove things down and go, it's fine, it's just my job, it's my work. But the truth is that, you know, we are affected by grief on a regular basis. Self-care is super important, but, you know, you can preach that as much as you like, but in all honesty, how many of us do it if it's not just a glass of wine or something, or maybe too many glasses of wine?
What do you do for self-care?
Me?
Wine.
Yeah, I don't mind a wine. But, I mean, I live by the beach, so, you know, I use nature, and, you know, I live on some land, so we have nice sunsets, and, you know, sometimes we just take time out just to put your feet on the earth and take a few breaths and think about the positive things that you've done, even in a time where other people are really affected by grief. As a team, though, you really need to look out for your teammates. You know, we've got our nurses out on the road, and certainly there are days that they come in, and I sort of talk about the fact that in our work we sort of wear a Teflon coat. It allows us to be present but not absorb all of the transference of grief and distress and anxiety that we're working in. But some days the Teflon coat leaks like a sieve, and you just feel all of it, and you feel the anguish and the hurt and the fear of the families that you're working with. And, you know, I think the thing that another misconception about palliative care is that we're only there at the end. I've certainly worked with people where I've been their nurse for 3 years, and when they die, I feel that, absolutely. So, you know, there are times you need to access staff care. You know, there are every health professional has access to peer support. I think it's just finding a balance and just acknowledging that sometimes it sucks, you know, it really does.
And I guess that sort of follows onto this one, is what is the hardest aspect or challenging aspect of being a palliative care nurse? Is it seeing those people you've built those relationships with for 3 years, or is there something else as well?
Yeah, look, I think the ones that I find hardest, I think the most challenging are, and I think everyone would find this in nursing, it's when you have a familiarity with someone. So, in my history of nursing, you know, there are probably half a dozen cases that I still feel very sad that they died, and usually it's because they're someone my age and a parent. So, you know, a mum my age, I've had a few with motor neuron disease, and, you know, we know what's coming, and we walk alongside for quite a few years, and when they die, it's really, really hard. So that's probably the hardest. I think the other really difficult part is that I don't think we're very good at acknowledging the impact that can have on nurses over a longer period of time. I hope us palliative care nurses don't come out just hard-assed, unfeeling people because we've put up too many walls. So I certainly do lots of work within our team about celebrating our wins. And we can't count our wins on how many lives we've saved, unlike some parts of nursing, but how many lives we've changed. So, you know, we're working with the creator of the kindness pandemic at the moment, and we're doing some work on acts of kindness and celebrating kindness in palliative care, which is, it's really nice to have some celebrations.
I think of all areas of nursing, care fatigue would be quite prominent in palliative care in particular.
Yeah.
I guess I think we'll sort of come to a close. I think we've touched on some really good topics, I guess, and I think we've really captured a bit more about what palliative care nursing is and its complexity. What advice would you have for those who are considering palliative care nursing?
Yeah. So there is a program called PEPPER, So PEPA, which is a palliative experience in the palliative approach. So it's a government-funded opportunity for nurses or allied health to spend 5 days back paid, supported, to spend time with the palliative care team and just pick up some experience. So we have quite a few people who come and do that with us, even GPs, just spending 5 days in palliative care. And you can split it across, you know, you might want to do a couple of days at Peter Mac, a couple of days at Barwon Health, you know, a day down at Lawn Community Hospital. I don't know what people like to do, or even at the children's, because pediatric palliative care is then a whole nother kettle of fish. You know, so those opportunities are there. But I just think, you know, take every opportunity you can in nursing to just experience as much as you can. I mean, I am so glad that I bit the bullet and gave up being a travel agent to be a nurse, you know. Not as good travel, well, but.
Yeah, yeah. Where's the next place you're going to travel to when COVID collapses?
Yeah, I don't know. I tell you what, I'm so lucky. At the end of last year, I was in Washington, D.C. and New York for a brain cancer conference, and, gee, things look very different there now. So I'm not sure that's the top of my list, and I was hoping to get to Italy next year, but I don't know about that yet either.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah. Up in the air.
Yeah.
I guess literally this is not one of the questions I had, but do you know much about palliative care in other countries, and I guess comparatively how we compare to other countries that are doing things much better or things that we need to start doing?
I think Australia is actually really advanced in palliative care, specialist palliative care. The UK, they've got some really strong programs as well. America tend to do things a little differently in palliative care, and I think that's probably around funding, and, you know, the fact that their whole medical system is very expensive to access. But I think the NHS and stuff in the UK is probably about the closest related to us. Unfortunately, I haven't been to one of the international PALCARE conferences yet. The brain cancer one I went to, I'm actually on the board of a brain cancer charity as well, so I went with that hat on.
Which charity is it?
The Peace of Mind Foundation.
Ah, cool. What do they do?
So peace, a bit of a plug. So Peace of Mind.
Just plug it.
Yeah, support brain cancer or brain tumor patients in the here and now. So any funding and money that comes in, we use to provide support, hands-on support to families. Brain cancers affect young people greatly. So we hold retreats, which are just fabulous. So women's retreat, men's retreat, and family retreat. And as far as we know, being on the world stage last year, we're the only brain cancer foundation in the world running these specific retreats, which is pretty awesome. And we also, you know, fund support groups and counselling and in-home supports and those sorts of things as well. Thanks for that opportunity.
Nah, go crazy. I think we'll finish it there, but I'll just quickly, are you happy you got a few minutes to answer some questions?
Sure.
Okay, let me just quickly go find some. Okay, this is not really a question, but more a statement. But Tracy says, would you consider giving a talk on these conversation techniques to a team of health professionals for a government department? We can put up Mel's details if she's happy with it.
Absolutely.
Brent, this is a long question. I'll quickly read it. Can you talk about the increasing role of paramedics in palliative care? I mean, you may not know much about that, but in Victoria, they now have an increased role with specific guidelines in supporting patients and families. How is it working, and how can it improve communication, medications, access?
Yeah, good question. I think probably I can speak really only for the area that I work in. We have noticed since those guidelines came out an increase in the number of phone calls that we would get from the paramedics in a patient's home. Rather than just automatically whisking them off to hospital, ringing and saying, hey, we're here with Mr. Smith. We know he's part of your program. He's called us because this has happened. he's pretty keen to stay at home. What would you like us to do? Where we can say, great, well, he's got some of this medication in the home. If you can just settle him, you know, maybe pop him back to bed, we'll send a nurse out and we'll take it from there, which has been fantastic. Mm. I think that one of the things that we needed to work on in palliative care was documenting people's goals of management and having documentation in the house so that if in a moment of panic or after a fall or after some delirium or something that the family call an ambulance, that the goals of management are really clear to the AMBOs, because unfortunately they have often been left in a situation where someone dies and they have to give CPR if there's no not for CPR orders in the house, which is an awful situation to put an AMBO in. So I hope that both sides are finding there's advantage to these pathways.
Have you heard of the Good Sam app?
Yeah.
I ended up, I've done a Good Sam, and me and my paramedic friend were going out of Bottle-O and ended up at someone's house doing CPR, someone with a PEA. And it was a really difficult situation because she had a colostomy bag, she had a urine bag, and she was clearly in her end days of dying.
Yeah.
But we got there and there was a son doing CPR on the mum, and the parents didn't want it to happen.
Yeah.
And but the kids did, and it was like this weird situation of we've rocked up to this house and there's like the family, there's that sort of disconnect, and we ended up doing CPR because the 000 operator said CPR has already been taken, already occurring. You have to do it. Mm. So I think what you said about those advanced care directives and having a really clear, because that was a traumatic death, to be honest. That was a really, really, really traumatic death. And I think that can be stopped if, I mean, this person had palliative care for sure. I mean, she was being palliated at home, but for some reason, you know, those last few minutes of panic, as you said, a fall or a sudden cardiac arrest can change everything in a moment and it all goes out the window.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. But if someone's got their advanced care directive on their fridge, it can make a difference.
It can make a difference. Bobby Mack says, this will be the last one, but he says, can you recommend education for staff working in a non-specialised palliative care area that addresses different cultural needs, such as you were saying, just saying regarding oral intake? I'm aware of certain cultures where trying to feed a loved one is seen as a gift or expression of love. It's very difficult to dissuade them from doing this.
Yeah.
Any education you would suggest for people?
There is a document that that talks about different cultures in palliative care that I'd be happy to share. But in all cultures and in all families, there are different beliefs and understandings about death and caring for someone. So I think that regardless of specific cultures, it still boils down to us having an understanding of who is this family, what are their beliefs, and how do we support them. So if it is culturally important that they continue to feed someone, we would find a way to make that happen. So it might just be that we say, okay, that's fine, let's do it as a half a teaspoon, let's go for really intense flavours, you know, and just put a different, you know, at-risk feeding, you know, really, it doesn't matter. As long as it's what the family are comfortable with. You know, we need to be really flexible.
And for those who don't know, at-risk feeding being at risk of aspiration?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I think that wraps it up. It's been absolutely awesome. I'm so glad that this worked out. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
We didn't have too many like internet issues either. But do you have any final words?
No, just thank you for the opportunity. I am more than happy to share my details. As you can tell, I love to have a chat. So I'm happy to engage at any level.
Awesome. I'll put your details up and thanks for coming, and I'm sure we'll speak soon.
Thanks, Jackson.
See ya. Bye.
See ya.